The 2024 NCAA March Madness Men's Tournament is back.
You can feel the madness.
This is the big dance.
The biggest event in college sports is kicking off Tuesday, March 19th, with the first four, and you don't want to miss a second of the action as we march all the way to the Final Four on April 6th and 8th. Catch all the clutch shots.
Long three.
It's good.
Big time plays.
Rejected.
Oh, what a pass.
Big finish.
Upsets, Cinderellas, Blue Bloods, and more.
Oh, my goodness.
Plus, this year, there are more ways to get in the game with Max.
What a move.
Dropping jaws here.
Tune in to the NCAA Men's Division I Basketball Championship, March 19th through April 8th on TBS, CBS, TNT, True TV, and stream on Max to stay up to date on the chase for a championship.
The madness is real.
Great basketball.
Oh, wow.
Great stories.
He's not human.
That's what this tournament is all about.
Hello again, this is Local Knowledge. I'm Shane Ryan, and I want to harken back early in this episode to something I wrote in 2015. Indulge me here, I usually try to keep my writing out of it, but I think in this case it's justified. It happens to be an interesting look back at the discourse around the OWGR, that's the official World Golf Ranking, 10 years ago, before everything that's happened with LIV Golf completely transformed that discourse. It's also a useful place for me to start, not only because of how things have changed, but because it lets me give a sort of overview of what OWGR is and how it works before we press ahead to modern times. I would say we're going to divide this episode loosely into three parts. The first part is the structure of the OWGR. And I can already tell I'm going to get sick of saying that. Can I just say ogre? Probably not. They probably wouldn't like me to call it the ogre. We'll have to keep saying all the initials, but we're going to talk about how it actually works in that first part. The second part is the history, how it came to be. And we can call the third part the present and the future, where it stands now and where it's going. And of course, we're going to address the big question whether the LIV PGA Tour schism has rendered it, after all these years, irrelevant or obsolete. So, let's go back almost a decade. It was early in my time here. And what I wrote was called Golf's World Rankings Are Almost Perfect. And if you don't get them, that's your problem. Very combative title, isn't it? Apparently I was in a fighting mood that day. Now, this was a different time, even though it was 9 years ago. Clearly, we didn't have a division in the sport that was calling everything into question. And there was no controversy about a league like LIV with some of the best golfers in the world who today are not getting world ranking points at all. The controversy then, and you have to almost laugh at it 9 years later about how small it was about who should be number one in the world. In this particular case, a strange thing had happened that doesn't happen often, but it can, where Jordan Spieth missed a cut, but somehow moved to number one in the world from number two. And there were a lot of people saying, you know, how can that happen? This system is broken. The world rankings are a joke, et cetera, et cetera. And my counterargument was, no, this is definitely a weird situation, but it's not broken. In fact, it's a very good system. I even called it brilliant. And my challenge was, you know, I defy you to think of anything better. The argument got into the weeds a little bit, but it started with a simple point, which was, okay, here are the top five players in the world by the OWGR. Do you disagree? And this was in September of 2015, so at that point it was Spieth, Rory McIlroy, Jason Day, Bubba Watson, and Ricky Fowler. And at the time, it was pretty inarguable that those were the best guys. And so the very simple point I was making was, before we get into the math, look, the results are right. The computer spits out the correct top five in the world. That might not be true anymore. It's probably not true, but at the time, it was true. And the second point I made was that the people who criticized it never seemed to have an alternative. And apologies for quoting myself, but I still think it's a salient point. I wrote, quote, ranking golfers is hard, whether pundits want to admit it or not. How do you weight bigger tournaments with superior fields against the weaker events? How far do you go back in time before the results are judged irrelevant? How do you incorporate the 100% necessary recency bias so Jack Nicklaus isn't the world's number one golfer today? What are the punishments for missing a cut, and what are the rewards for an outright win? End quote. And what I tried to convey is that the OWGR had answers for all of that, and they were good answers. And I just want to give a broad outline of how it actually works, because I do think it's misunderstood, or in some cases just not understood. And if you don't like math and technical stuff, this might get a little boring, but I'm going to keep it short, so bear with me. At the time, I boiled it down to five basic points that I think still work. So, point one, they take 104 weeks of results. That's 2 years. Point two, you get points based on how you finish a tournament. More points for a higher finish, obviously. Point three, and here we start to get complicated. The tournament field whether it's weak or strong, can raise or lower the number of points. So obviously a Challenge Tour event, if you win that, it's not going to yield the number of points that winning a PGA Tour event would yield. A PGA Tour event won't yield what winning a major will yield. They have these world rating charts and home rating charts to give them their collective strength of field, and then they calculate how much each finisher should earn. Now, point four. In terms of total points, the last 13 weeks of your career are counted in full. And then each week after that, for 104 weeks, everything goes down by about 1% less each week, a little more than 1%, until the 105th week when it's not worth anything anymore. It disappears into the fog of time, no longer counts. So if you win a major a year ago, that's still going to be worth something. If you win it 3 years ago, it no longer counts. And point five, finally, all these points are added up, divided by total events played, and that's your number, and then you're ranked against everyone else. So, is it complicated? Yes, but in my mind, it needs to be complicated. There's no simple way to calculate this stuff, period. There just isn't. And back in 2015, to me, it felt like a really good system that produced good results. It was intuitive, and ultimately, the list of players from number one down to 100 made sense. So, things have to be complicated. Airplanes are complicated. Buildings are complicated. If the problem in front of you is not simple, the solution probably won't be simple either. And that explains why Spieth rose above Rory to be number one in the world. The week he missed the cut, got 0 points, and Rory happened to gain, 3 points or something like that for finishing T29 at the Deutsche Bank. But remember, there's also a week falling off the charts completely and something like 90 weeks decreasing in value just a little bit. And Rory had 2 wins in 2014 at the majors. He won the Open and he won the PGA at Valhalla. Those were fading into time. They were now more than a year old, worth less. While Spieth, of course, that year in 2015, won 2 majors, almost won all of them, and they were still counting for more. And the math worked out in a strange way that the 3 points Rory gained were offset by whatever he was losing and whatever Spieth wasn't losing, and Spieth rose above him. This was rare, but for me, it didn't say anything bad about the system. In fact, I wrote, that to me is a sign of the OWGR's health, not its weakness. It's the odd exception that proves the rule. So, there you go. That was the take back in 2015. That was the snapshot. And today, of course, all we're talking about with OWGR is LIV, which we'll get to. But first, I want to take you even further back in time to the origins of the OWGR, as in, how did we get world rankings in the first place? Were they always there? The answer to that is no, of course. And this is one of those cases in history where we owe quite a bit, not everything, but a good chunk, to a single person. And that person is Mark McCormack, who you could do an entire podcast on, and I think one day we will. He's that interesting. But for now, I'll give you the cliff notes, and this information comes from several sources, but 3 especially helpful ones were 2 older SI pieces, one from 1990 by E.M. Swift, one from even earlier, 1975 by Ray Kennedy, and then a Golf Digest piece by Ross Goodner in 1979. And for those last 2 sources, I have to thank Jerry Tardy here at Golf Digest. We had a conversation. He drew them up from memory, knew them right away. So let's start with Swift at SI, who points out that for McCormack, golf was an original piece of the puzzle. Now, this guy would become maybe the most impressive sports business figure of his time, but as a kid growing up in Chicago, he fractured his skull in a car accident, and part of his recovery was playing golf. He became very, very good. He won the Chicago Prep title, played in college at William & Mary, and in one of his matches there, he met a golfer from Wake Forest named Arnold Palmer. McCormack went to Yale Law after that, served in the Army for a short stint. Then he went to work at a Cleveland law firm. But he never lost his love for golf. And one thing he started to do in Cleveland was to book exhibitions for pro golfers. Through this, he met and impressed a lot of pros. And some of them, knowing he was a lawyer, said, hey, will you review this endorsement contract? Can you take a look? And Arnold Palmer was one of those people. And McCormack eventually decided, you know what, I'm going to go into business for myself. This was 1960, and he had one client, and that was Palmer. And his vision, which sounds basic now, but it's one of those visions that everybody, it would totally make sense today, but at the time, it was really forward-thinking, nobody else was on this in the same way, is that the world of athlete endorsements was about to expand in a pretty huge way. And he had a great client, obviously, in Palmer, and the endorsement deals that he started to work out for him were raising eyebrows all over. Pretty soon, he had signed Gary Player, he had signed Jack Nicklaus, and between the 3 of these guys, in almost no time at all, he had a vice grip on golf, really the 3 best clients that you could have. He called his new company IMG. And what's really interesting is that he surprised people. As late as 1990, when Swift wrote his piece, people that worked with McCormack were saying that, you know, part of the reason for this guy's success was the lack of competent competition. And of course, the other reasons are his own inventiveness, the faith he put in his people if they showed that they could be aggressive and smart, and, you know, the visionary quality that McCormack had, that sort of genius, if you want to put it that way, if you can put the word genius in that business context, he was absolutely a genius. Now, that is just part of it. Swift goes into the other side of things. McCormack had former employees who called him vindictive, vicious, a manipulator, things like that. He was accused of using speakerphones in his Cleveland office to spy on people. One Fortune 500 head that Swift found for a story said that, quote, my stomach tells me that McCormack is the ultimate hustler, that he will use you to the nth degree. There's something shady and unattractive about him. He doesn't give much eye contact. I wish I could be more specific. It's just a feeling I have. End quote. Every article you read about McCormack, you get the same thing. Here's Kennedy from SI way back in 75 who wrote, quote, in Britain, he has been called Mark the Knife. In New Zealand, the traveling computer. In France, the Midas of muscle. And in the US, well, take your pick. Parasite, megalomaniac, and cold fish are a few of the more endearing appraisals. End quote. He was also an imposing physical presence, described by Goodner in Golf Digest as tall, handsome man of 48 whose blonde hair is turning gray. And when I spoke to Jerry Tardy, he had memories of him under the oak tree at Augusta. He was always carrying sheets of paper under an arm. He was always moving around quickly. And when he moved, everybody would get out of his way. There was a good deal of intimidation to this guy, according to almost everyone. But IMG became huge. When Swift wrote his piece, they had more than 1,000 employees, more than $700 million in revenue, and people at the company were even saying that it was growing too fast. Same was true 15 years earlier when Kennedy and SI wrote, quote, depending on the sport and the services rendered, IMG's fee can go as high as 50% of a player's total earnings. The average is 25%. And why not, says McCormack, who earns $500,000 a year. We have the context, we have the expertise, and we have the clients. We don't do anything for 10%. End quote. And they represented everyone from Bjorn Borg to Muhammad Ali to Jean-Claude Killy, this famous skier at the time. Their reach was unbelievable. Not only that, they were involved with TV rights. They negotiated at places like Wimbledon, golf tournaments. You hear that they were called Octopus Unlimited by their detractors, and you get why. The reach was incredible. The tentacles were everywhere in sport. Ross Goodner at Digest, his piece was more golf-focused, obviously. He wrote about how McCormack could control every side of a deal. He wrote, quote, what McCormack does so effectively is work both sides of the street. He puts together package deals in which all the parties involved are clients of his. For example, he might create a tournament for which he would sell the sponsorships, provide the players, negotiate the television rights, and market a film afterward, then collect a percentage from all parties as the representative. His critics call this conflict of interest, but their slings and arrows don't bother McCormack. He says he scrupulously makes full disclosure to all sides in advance, and besides, nobody's forced to sign anything. End quote. And by the way, this is kind of interesting, but even in 79, one of McCormack's big beefs was with the PGA Tour, who he thought were, quote, strangling the growth of golf around the world. And Goodner even says that McCormack had thoughts of starting a global tour of his own, a breakaway tour, but Arnold Palmer told him he wouldn't leave the PGA Tour, so he never really followed through on that. But you can hear in that sentiment the echoes of what was to come many years later. And McCormack is gone now. He passed away in 2003 after a heart attack. But IMG is still this massive media company. He built a juggernaut. They're owned by Endeavor today, a company that had merged with William Morris, another big talent agency, and then acquired IMG for $2.4 billion in 2013. And the list of players they represent includes people like Jordan Spieth, Patrick Cantlay, Francesco Molinari, a lot of great women's players, Georgia Hall, Lydia Ko, Michelle Wee, Daniel Kang, etc., etc., not to mention tennis players like Novak Djokovic and Serena Williams, and big athletes and celebrities all over the spectrum. So, it's this great success story in American business, but through it all, the growth, the controversy, everything, McCormack never lost his passion for golf. And starting in 1968, 8 years after IMG started, he published something called the World of Professional Golf Annual. And he did it every year, as the name would indicate, and part of that publication were his world golf rankings. And he would take results from all over the world, Europe, Asia, America, Africa, Australia, everything he could find. And he built this rudimentary but pretty impressive system that took a 3-year period, awarded more points for recent achievements, more points for majors, or even tour events with strong fields. And as you can see, point by point, this is a true forerunner to the OWGR. And it also shows how brilliant McCormack was. I mean, this guy was so numbers-oriented, it was incredible. And this is an important part of the McCormack story to me, because he's often portrayed as this very single-minded, almost greedy, manipulative character. His entire goal is to grow and make more money. But as Jerry Tardy pointed out when we spoke, the fact that he put this stuff out, that he kept world rankings, it shows there had to be some independent love of golf. And that word love sounds so strange to use with him, and I doubt he would use it himself, but what else can you call it? And it still resided somewhere in his soul. Almost seems contradictory or paradoxical, but it was there. And with his rankings, there were a lot of differences today. He only rewarded high finishes. You only got points if you were in the top 10 at a major, for instance. Again, it was 3 years instead of 2 years that they use today. But in the broad strokes, he built the thing that they eventually used. Jack Nicklaus was the first number one, and clearly he deserved it. But also, he was McCormack's client, so there was some friction there. You know, is he just doing it for his own self-interest, for his own business reasons? But Nicklaus actually left IMG in 1970. He felt he was getting short shrift compared to Palmer, and he remained number one in the rankings long after he left. So it wasn't like this was tweaked to benefit McCormack and IMG. By all measures, he had his system, he plugged the data in, and whatever came out, came out. There was integrity there, and you can trace the way golf evolved over that time by these rankings. You know, at first the rankings were half and half Americans and non-Americans. Then by the mid-70s, it was all Americans. And by the end, by 1985, the top three are not Americans. Again, it's Seve Ballesteros, Bernard Langer, Greg Norman. The scene is shifting toward a more global game. By this time, the Open Championship and their governing body, the RNA, was realizing that their invitation system was flawed because of the way players split time between tours. And so, long story short, they weren't getting some of the best players sometimes. And up to this point, McCormack's rankings were never used for anything beyond people reading them, being interested in them. They weren't used for exemptions or invites to majors or anything like that. But the RNA was the first to recognize that actually they needed a world ranking system for more than just popular interest. So in 1986, the official world golf ranking was officially launched. Mark McCormack was the chairman of what was called the International Advisory Committee that oversaw the rankings. That committee was essentially an extension of IMG, and the first system they used was based almost exactly on the rankings that McCormack had been doing for years. Things were tweaked over time with some frequency. You can trace the evolution all the way up to today. In 1990, a big moment came when the PGA Tour recognized these rankings. By 1997, every major had recognized them. And in 2004, IMG gave up the rankings, and ever since, it's been run by a company literally called the official World Golf Ranking. And that company has 7 members, and it's exactly who you'd think. PGA of America, USGA, PGA Tour, Augusta, the RNA, the PGA European Tour, and a group called the International Federation of PGA Tours. And if this were a history podcast, we'd say this ushered in an era of peace. Not without quibbles, minor skirmishes on the edge of the empire, but in general, the rankings were accepted, adhered to, and didn't spark almost any controversy. And this lasted until the first players started leaving for LIV Golf. And in just a couple short years, today, we are in what I'd consider the most precarious moment in the OWGR's history. Everything to this point has been either growth in the early days or stability in the middle to late period, but now, for the first time, I believe the OWGR is facing a collapse. Earlier this month, on March 6, Joel Beal wrote a piece here at Digest called "Golf's World Ranking is More Trouble Than It's Worth." The obvious issue now, as Beal notes, is that LIV Golf isn't getting any world ranking points, so the players that have jumped ship are plummeting down the list. And because the OWGR dictates in large part who gets into majors, now you have some of the best players in the world who either need a special exemption, like Joaquin Neiman got at Augusta this year, or just aren't going to get in, even though, based on skill, they probably deserve to, somebody like Taylor Gooch. And the further they drop, the situation is going to get worse, not better. because it's going to be harder and harder to evaluate who exactly should get special permission at these events when you have nothing to evaluate them against except their own self-contained league. There's also the matter of perception. Last October, Liv's application to get world rankings was denied by the OWGR board, and the decision was based, at least nominally, on two critical factors: the 54-hole no-cut format of 48-player fields, and both the limited access for players to join Liv and the limited relegation for players who underperform. Here was the quote from Peter Dawson, the chairman of the OWGR board. Quote, "The important point is this is not about the players. Liv players are self-evidently good enough to be ranked. There is no doubt about that. This is about should a tour whose formats are so different and whose qualification criteria are so different, can they be ranked equitably with other tours who conform to the OWGR norm and have more competition to them than perhaps the closed shop that is Liv?" End quote. In other words, there's no effective way to evaluate these guys, and that term, closed shop, was used repeatedly. And you can get a sense of how quickly everything can change by this stat that Joel Beal dug up. He wrote, quote, "When Liv began, it boasted nearly 24 players in the world's top 100. As of this writing, only 2 Liv members are in the top 50 and 6 in the top 100. End quote. And that was from the piece he wrote last October, not the recent one. The situation is even worse now. And it's worth noting, just as a side note, that for whatever it's worth, Jay Monahan of the PGA Tour, Keith Pelley of the European Tour, and Keith Waters of the International Federation of PGA Tours all recuse themselves from this vote, you know, to give the appearance that there's no conflict of interest here. Again, for whatever that's worth. And in response to all this, Liv said exactly what you'd expect them to say, that the OWGR can no longer deliver on this objective of ranking the best players in the world. Here's part of their statement, quote, "A ranking which fails to fairly represent all participants, irrespective of where in the world they play golf, robs fans, players, and all of golf's stakeholders of the objective basis underpinning any accurate recognition of the world's best player performances. It also robs some traditional tournaments of the best fields possible," end quote. Which is some truth to it. Whether or not you think these guys brought it on themselves by taking the Liv money in the first place, you know, this is part of the bargain, you no longer get to be in that system. Even if this is their just desserts, you can't deny that there are some of these guys who, based on their skill level, would be in major championships that aren't there anymore. Now, I would argue that the public only cares about this a little. Even talking about really big golf fans here. That's just my opinion. But I think in the abstract, everybody wants the best fields in the major, sure. But there are a few mitigating factors. One of which is that exemptions are going to keep a lot of these guys there for a very long time. John Rahm, Cam Smith, Brooks Koepka, they don't have to worry about getting into majors, at least right now. Second, you're going to see more and more moves like Augusta made this year, which is letting Joaquin Neiman in with an exemption, but nobody else. But by letting in Neiman, they sort of blunt the most egregious omission, the one everybody was talking about, right? We saw Neiman's interview where after he won a live event, he's saying, yeah, but I'm not in the majors anymore. So Augusta invites him and they cleverly take the air out of what might have been some legitimate public unrest. And they at least give the impression that they're paying attention and they're reacting. It was a very smart preemptive strike, I thought. And when, you know, the only omission left is somebody like Taylor Gooch, that's not going to move the needle. And that may end up protecting the OWGR. But the secondary problem for Liv, as I said before, is a perception one, by which I mean that when they are denied world rankings, it gives fuel to this idea that they are fundamentally an unserious exhibition league. So they want the world rankings because they want their players to be competing in and winning majors, yes, but they also want the league-wide credibility that comes from having the blessing of the world rankings. That's one of their great battles, to be taken seriously, and getting denied had to hurt. Now, earlier this week, they said, actually, we don't want them anymore. Liv rescinded its world rankings application, decided they're not even going to try for it at this point. Beal, in his piece, called this a "you can't fire me, I quit" type move, which seems right. And it's also a smart move in some ways. It's calling their bluff. It's saying, we're not even going to try for the kind of legitimacy you offer because we don't recognize it as legitimate. So instead of joining them, now they're undermining them. And Beal includes recent quotes from people like Matt Fitzpatrick, who, of course, is a PGA Tour player, not a Liv guy, who said, quote, "I don't really look at them or pay attention to them anymore. I don't think they're right." Again, that's a PGA Tour player talking about the OWGR. Fitzpatrick says he looks at Data Golf instead. He thinks it's a better representation. And Dave Shedlosky wrote a story here at Digest with additional quotes from Xander Schauffele and Will Zalatoris saying similar things. You know, Joaquin Niemann isn't number 73 in the world. Nobody believes that. It's just not correct. And Beal, in his piece, he's not endorsing that Liv should get points. He calls that basically a self-defeating exercise and says, quote, "The moment you assert why you matter is the moment you prove the opposite," end quote. But he has other qualms about the system, too. For instance, why does a player who wins a tournament in South Africa or South Korea get more points for that win than someone finishing 10th at a major? Why does something like the Hero World Challenge get points? Even in the system as it stands, outside of Liv, and even with all the tweaks they've made over the years, there are some head-scratchers. And some of these you can actually understand, even if they are technically inequitable. Some of them are about giving value to the global parts of the game. And you can justify that with, well, even if it's sort of an artificial boost, it's good to give them that little leg up. It's good for the game. We need some of these guys in these fields. It's going to grow golf in general. But others are tougher to explain. And no matter if the justification for denying Liv is valid, it can't help reflect poorly on the OWGR just for the fact that a guy like Jon Rahm isn't getting world ranking points anymore. You know, if the OWGR were the NCAA, they would find a way to give him points, if only to justify themselves and keep them from being seen as totally irrelevant. There would be more of a survival instinct, but for now, they're holding pat. Beal's conclusion is, you don't need this. Here's how he finishes his piece. Quote, "Abolishing the OWGR because of Liv may seem like a surrender from the rest of the sport. In reality, golf schism has provided the chance to evaluate everything in the professional ecosystem and identify what's really needed, what's lacking, and what likely should go. Ranking golfers should be a fun exercise, not something put into practice. Liv's complaints about the OWGR's existence are based on the wrong rationale, but overall, the complaints are probably right." End quote. So, how would you do it if you did get rid of the OWGR? In January 2023, Sam Wyman here at Digest wrote a very thought-provoking piece with the idea of establishing a kind of professional handicap based on comparative scores and course difficulty, which seemed like it could be refined into something very effective and would be pretty interesting to follow. As Fitzpatrick noted, a lot of people are turning to Data Golf and trusting those rankings. It is arguably easier now, even than 10 years ago, with the prevalence of mathematically and statistically inclined minds who have turned their attention to golf, to devise a more useful system. The one issue is that a lot of these ideas are coming from outside the inner sanctum of the game, and you have to think that, okay, first, the governing bodies aren't going to want to give up control of this, period, right? That's going to be the ultimate first obstacle that you have. But second, even if they did or even if they adjusted, they're going to want to keep certain aspects of the ratings that aren't perfectly balanced, like how maybe there's a boost for global golfers, people outside the US and Europe, to give opportunities to players in these far-flung locations. And whatever the solution is, as we said before, it's not going to be simple, because it's not a simple problem. But that's only if the OWGR collapses, which is still a long way away, and there are a lot of political impediments in the way of that. The OWGR has a long and rich history. It has served and continues to serve an important function, but there's no doubt that it's under attack for some very valid reasons, and that it looks from the outside less useful and especially less accurate than ever before. In the next year, we're going to learn a lot about the OWGR, but most importantly, we're going to learn whether it has the flexibility and the good luck to survive. Local Knowledge is produced by Greg Gottfried with editorial guidance from Sam Weinman. Our music for today's episode was called Ambient Blues Joe, and that's by Lobo Loco. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to Local Knowledge wherever you get your podcasts, and check out Golf Digest's other podcasts, The Loop and Golf IQ. If you're a Golf Digest Plus subscriber, and you should be, try out our new exclusive newsletters. We have Low Net, Golf IQ, and Undercover Pro.
Hello, I'm Luke Cardinine, the host of the Golf IQ podcast, and we've got some very exciting news here in Golf Digest land. It's a new newsletter available exclusively to Golf Digest Plus members, and it'll land in your inbox once a week. It's the greatest newsletter in all the land here at Golf Digest, but I admit there is an upstart rival in the ranks, and it goes by the name of the Low Net newsletter with Sam Wyman, who's here right now. Sam, what's the lowdown on your newsletter?
Well, my newsletter, Luke, is the reason that you are competing for second place at best. My newsletter, as you said, is called Low Net. It's geared towards golfers like myself who are very much in the middle of the pack at your course or your club. It's a game I live and breathe, and I'm obsessed with getting better.
No, in all seriousness, it's a great read. It's full of not just really interesting and helpful stuff, but really relatable stuff from the man who probably loves golf the most of anybody here at Golf Digest. So head over to golfdigest.com/plus. Sign up and start enjoying both of these awesome newsletters each and every week.